Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host for this episode, Dr. Christine Smith from Salt Lake City. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Jamie Oliver at the University of Kansas Medical Center and Dr. Jennifer Vilwak at the University Hospitals at Cleveland Medical Center and Case Western Reserve University to discuss their paper, Systemic Estrogen Therapy is Associated with Lower Surgical Intervention Rates for Nasal Obstruction, which was published in the fall of 2025 as a research note in the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. Dr. Oliver is the first author on this publication, and Dr. Vilwak is the senior author, and I think it's very timely that we're recording this episode the day after International Women's Day. Welcome to you both, and congratulations to you and your co-authors on your paper.
Thank you very much for having us here. Excited to talk about it.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Thank you. Well, let's jump right into our discussion. There is an increasing interest and body of literature examining the role that sex hormones play in nasal physiology. Many clinicians have observed that patients report changes in nasal symptoms during pregnancy, menstruation, or menopause, suggesting that these hormones, particularly estrogen, may influence nasal mucosa and function. Dr. Oliver or Vilwak, can you start us off by giving our listeners a little background on how estrogen is thought to influence the nasal airway and nasal physiology?
Absolutely. And so I think before we really start having a detailed conversation about sex hormones, we really need to start by noting that the impact of these hormones on women and females is highly nuanced and also very complex. And as I'm sure you already know, Dr. Oliver and I are both otolaryngologists and rhinologists, and probably just like you, your clinical training and our clinical training did not emphasize hormonal contributions to health or pathophysiology. So I think that given that, what we are learning about the role of hormones in sinonasal health is super important, and we shouldn't just ignore the complexity just to make our lives easier as otolaryngologists. And so all of that to say, a lot of times when we think about these hormones in an effort to simplify things, they're often discussed in isolation, which can become problematic because of that nuance. And so more so than just doing one thing or another thing, reproductive hormones are really modulators and regulators of function that have impacts on a variety of levels. And a lot of animal models do show that they likely exert their effects in concert with one another, which can make it a little bit problematic when you're trying to say like, okay, well, what does just estrogen do? Or what does just progesterone do? So we have to be very careful in how we design and interpret studies in this area. So with all that said, to answer your question, we know that generally speaking, hormones like estrogen and progesterone do impact sinonasal airway physiology and nasal patency. And those are through mechanisms like vascular engorgement. They also play a role in inflammatory cell migration and also mucociliary clearance. And so we know that those functions are important because with hormonal withdrawal states, like we see in menopause, things like mucociliary clearance become prolonged, olfactory dysfunction becomes more prevalent, et cetera. And we also know that generally estrogen increases nasal engorgement. Together, estrogen and progesterone promote eosinophilic migration into nasal mucosa. And so all of that taken together explains some of the clinical findings we see, like a shift towards allergic rhinitis as females are going through puberty, et cetera.
Yeah, thank you for emphasizing that. I agree. This is not an area that was emphasized in my training. So that's really important to keep in mind. Your paper highlights a few studies that have examined the relationship between hormone replacement therapy and nasal symptoms. Can you talk a little bit more about what prior studies have shown regarding these hormone changes and nasal function?
Yeah, some of the literature that has been really well done has been examining what happens during the menstrual cycle, right? Because this is a reproducible occurrence where we can reliably study things that are happening during different hormonal shifts. Mm-hmm. So we do see clinically that there's changes in nasal patency and subjective obstruction scores. And like I mentioned earlier, generally estrogen seems to promote vascular engorgement. And so there tends to be higher subjective obstruction scores. when estrogen is higher. Same thing for upper airway resistance. When you have estrogen dominance, particularly during the follicular phase, as compared to during the luteal phase, where progesterone is more dominant. And interestingly, there's also reproducible changes that happen at the level of the nasal epithelium itself with the menstrual cycle. And so that's one of the reasons why it's thought that perhaps some of the symptoms that we see in menopause have to do with things like decreased nasal epithelial integrity, which is responsive to hormones. And that might explain why we're seeing more non-allergic rhinitis in that population.
That's very interesting. And then what led your group to ask this particular research question? What made you wonder whether systemic estrogen therapy might influence the likelihood of patients ultimately undergoing nasal airway surgery?
So the idea for the project actually came from outside of the rhinology literature for me. I had been reading the book Blind Spots by Dr. Marty McCary, who's FDA commissioner now. And he had been talking about prior missteps within the medical field where we've unfortunately as a community potentially led to suboptimal care for patients. And one of the topics the book really explores in detail, and I would recommend that, I have no, you know, association with it, but they do focus a lot on hormone replacement therapy and how there's been a lot of publicity about some of the risks and a lot less publicity about many of the benefits, including decreased all-cause mortality, cardiovascular events, and osteoporosis, to name a few. You know, as I was listening to that, there's a brief mention of hormonal changes that leading to nasal dryness and congestion. And the rhinologist in me really picked up on that. And so when we started looking at the literature, there was actually a paper in 2024 from Kevin Herr and the folks at USC that showed that hormone replacement therapy in patients with CRS led to a substantially reduced associated rate of sinus surgery for patients who have chronic rhinosinusitis. And so, I mean, that CRS is definitely a more complicated condition, but the idea that estrogen could also influence sinonasal physiology in something that would conceivably be a bit more static, like septal deviation, was something that we decided we wanted to explore as well.
Yeah, that's such an interesting origin of a research project. I really like that. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the design of your study. You guys used the TrinetX database to perform a retrospective cohort study. And for listeners who may not be familiar with this platform, can you briefly explain what it is and why it can be a useful tool for answering population level clinical questions?
Yeah, so I think many of us in academia have really seen an explosion of these large data set based research publications and findings. And Trinetix is one example of a large data set that can be leveraged for those purposes. It provides access to electronic health record and claims data from, at this point, about 100 million patients, with data being contributed from 60 or so different healthcare organizations. So just from those numbers alone, you can see that there's really a wealth of data to explore here, and it's essentially providing real-world data that's pooled from these multiple sources, which can be really useful. For example, if you're trying to evaluate a rare condition, right, that otherwise you would have to go through the rigmarole of finding collaborators at a bunch of different institutions and then designing your retrospective review and going through 10,000 different IRBs, this kind of eliminates the need for all of that kind of logistical nonsense and allows real-time access to the data, which can be very helpful. And a lot of what we're seeing in otolaryngology is retrospective studies, similar to the one that we're describing today. And it can be a really great tool for vetting and generating hypotheses where you really need like this big picture amount of data, but it also has limitations, of course. So like, I think as a researcher who's focused on sensory dysfunction, particularly olfaction, I would love to use Trinetix to answer questions about what's happening, you know, and with olfaction and menopause, and how does that relate to things like cognitive outcomes that we really care about downstream and dementia risk. But olfactory dysfunction is very under-recognized and under-diagnosed. So if you're relying on a data set that's pulling in that recognition and those diagnostic codes, you can't really use it for those sorts of projects. So in any case, regardless of what you're using Trinetix for, with those sorts of caveats in mind, you have to be thinking intentionally about how you're going to vet the subsequent results and put them into context.
That's a great segue to my next question, which is, how did you guys actually define your study population to optimize the use of this database and get good results?
Yes. So there's definitely, as Dr. Vilwak mentioned, limitations in terms of data granularity. And so we selected women over 55 years of age with a diagnosis of either septal deviation or turbinate hypertrophy. And we compared those who were on oral estrogen hormone replacement therapy compared to those who were not on any hormone replacement therapy of any modality. And we specifically focused on oral because that was the most common use for it and didn't really have other conceivable indications that you would expect patients to be on it for in that population. You could potentially lower your age a little bit, but at that point, it's conceivable that patients could be on it for OCPs, and the ability to distinguish exactly who's on it for what is something that's hard to discern in the database. We did exclude patients with prior surgery. So anyone who had a septoplasty, turbinate surgery in the past, or an endoscopic sinus surgery was excluded. And we also excluded folks who had a history of CF or sinonasal malignancy.
It sounds like you are trying to design a really clear cohort to try and minimize some of those potential confounders. And you touched on this a little bit, but were there any other factors you considered in terms of deciding on those inclusion criteria?
Yes, we didn't want to have, again, I think it's making the cohort clean was a goal of ours. And so it's not that if you're under 55, this won't work. Really, the emphasis in the literature is that as soon as you can start hormone replacement therapy, the better, as in within the first 10 years of menopause. And so I don't want it to be misconstrued that way. But really, we just wanted a clean cohort for it and not have any kind of overlapping indications.
That sounds like a really thoughtful design. And then another key part of your methodology was this propensity score matching. Can you explain what that involves and why it was important for your analysis?
Yeah, because this was an observational study, there's always the concern that patients who are receiving hormone therapy may be different systematically from those who are not. And so to address this, the propensity scoring attempts to balance the two groups across all the variables we were matching for to ensure that they're comparable. And so in this instance, we specifically used the one-to-one nearest neighbor matching approach, and that ensured that after review, there were no significant differences between the groups.
Excellent. And then for our listeners, what types of variables did you include in that matching process?
Patients were matched for age, race, diagnosis of chronic sinusitis, as well as diagnosis of polyposis. We also matched folks with history of chronic rhinitis, allergic rhinitis, or asthma. And by matching for those and including everyone, we did want to make it more generalizable rather than excluding folks who've had those conditions. In terms of medications, we also matched patients based on whether or not they were on ACE inhibitors or beta blockers.
Why did you choose those two medications?
Both of those, you know, ACE inhibitors have been associated with rhinorrhea and congestion, and then beta blockers have also been associated with increased congestion and drainage. One limitation, again, in talking about the database work that requires kind of reproducibility in an institutional setting is just the limited ability to get good data on over-the-counter medications. And so while kind of the first thing you'd think as a rhinologist is, are they on sinus rinses? Are they using nasal steroid sprays? Those are things that we looked at but found weren't routinely coded. And so we're not balanced on that.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that. And then let's move on to the results of your study. After matching, you ended up with several cohorts, including patients with septal deviation and turbinate hypertrophy, as well as a combined diagnosis group. What did the demographics of those matched populations ultimately look like? Did anything jump out as important to you to consider?
Good question. Our patients were ultimately matched successfully in the sense that there were no statistically significant differences based on those variables we outlined before. The mean age in the cohort was 65 years old. And our largest cohort was the septal deviation cohort with about 1,000 in the hormone replacement therapy and non-hormone side versus about 500 for the turbinate cohort and 300 for our combined cohort that included patients who have both a diagnosis of septal deviation and turbinate hypertrophy. Otherwise, there weren't a lot of things that jumped out to us. About a quarter of them had chronic sinusitis and 16 to 20% had a diagnosis of rhinitis. And so there was a good distribution on that, and about 17% had asthma. So I think it is fairly representative of what you see in the clinic.
Yeah, it definitely looks that way to me. And then your primary outcome was septoplasty and inferior turbinate surgery within 5 years of diagnosis. What did you find when you compared surgical rates between the HRT and non-HRT groups?
Yeah, so we saw quite large reductions in rates of surgery. There was a relative reduction of about 50% in terms of septoplasties that were performed and a relative reduction of about 70% for turbinate surgery. And this translated to about, for turbinates, 9% versus 3% undergoing surgery, and then septoplasty, 5% versus 2.3%. And then the largest difference we noted was for the combined cohort. So when patients were diagnosed with both septal deviation and turbinate hypertrophy, there was an 80% lower likelihood of surgery in the hormone replacement therapy group. It was just 2.5% in that group compared to about 12% for the patients who are not on HRT.
Yeah, I thought those findings were quite striking to see that hormone replacement therapy was associated with substantially lower rates of turbinate surgery and septoplasty. And when I looked at the relative risk reduction, it really looked like it ranged from about 50% to 80%, depending on the cohort, which is very clinically significant. Was this in keeping with what you were expecting? This seems like a really significant difference between the cohorts when I was looking at it.
I was not shocked by that. You know, there was not a prior study that looked specifically at nasal airway surgery and hormone replacement therapy. And so I don't think we had a direct number that we were shooting for. But I mentioned previously the other Trinetic study looking at rates of endoscopic sinus surgery, and their reduction, I want to say, was on the order of about 70% relative reduction as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think in keeping with that, it was not a big difference from what has been shown kind of in a similar space. And ultimately, Dr. Vilwalk and I have also, since publishing this, done a paper on rates of middle ear surgery, which also went down substantially with hormone replacement therapy. So I think all of the studies are kind of pointing in a similar direction of mucociliary clearance improvement does lead to reduced surgery for these patients. Although talking about symptom control and all that is something that is honestly harder to define when you're using databases like this.
Were there any findings in particular that surprised you or your research team?
I wouldn't say that we were surprised. You know, as Dr. Oliver mentioned, there is existing data, at least at the time that we published this manuscript, to support that, yes, there's something that is happening with hormone replacement therapy that is impacting the physiology in a positive way. But I think that where the surprise comes from is trying to link those data set-based findings, right, with what we could conceivably believe that the underlying mechanism is. And I think that this is where some of the nuance comes in, right? Because we've already talked about how generally estrogen is thought to be pro-inflammatory or pro-engorgement, right? Which is why we think that we see so much rhinitis occurring in pregnancy and during different phases of the menstrual cycle. So if you took that tidbit of information in isolation, you would be like, your results don't make any sense, right? Based on what we know, right? Because as estrogen decreases, engorgement, et cetera, should decrease as well, right? So you should have more space for breathing. So why would these folks with these anatomic findings be proceeding to surgery if things are getting better based on that knowledge as estrogen decreases? But we also know from prior studies that we've kind of alluded to that these reproductive hormones exert other effects, right? And Jamie was talking about mucociliary clearance. We also know things about epithelial barrier function and how important these sex hormones are for that. So it's possible and probably more likely that the reason that we see these findings that are surprising in the context of isolated knowledge is that it's the balance of all these functions, which is probably being normalized somewhat with hormone replacement therapy, that's important for the sensation of nasal patency, as opposed to one single action.
That's a very interesting hypothesis. And you're right. When I initially saw the results of your paper, it was a bit counter to what I expected with my limited knowledge of the way that we assume estrogen works in the nose. Were there any other hypotheses or thoughts on why we're seeing this difference that you wanted to highlight in the discussion here?
I think that I would just point to some of the literature that exists in the menstrual cycle, right, for mm-hmm. what is happening as there's these different predominance of estrogen or progesterone or relative decrease of hormones overall. And so one finding that has sparked some additional hypotheses for me is that typically in the ovulatory phase, women have worse subjective nasal obstruction, but then they also have the greatest magnitude of decongestive response to topical agents. So part of me wonders, like, is the impact of our first line topical medications also moderated by the presence or absence of reproductive hormones, right? So maybe it's a constellation of things, the anatomy plus mucociliary clearance plus inherent responsiveness to these targeted intranasal steroids or antihistamines, et cetera, that is being moderated by the presence or absence of these reproductive hormones during times of hormonal transition. Don't know, right? But another hypothesis that comes up as you try to put these findings into the context of the burgeoning scientific knowledge base around menopause and female reproductive hormones.
Sounds like we have a lot more questions to answer. Can you guys talk about the limitations of this analysis and how we should consider them when we interpret the results?
Yes, I think we've touched on some of these already, kind of as we've discussed the results, but you know, the first thing you'll hear with any database study is that it's retrospective and observational. And so we cannot definitively say that this is a causal relationship at this point. There's enough associations out there in the literature showing similar things that I think that we're suspecting that, but these things do have to be validated prospectively at some point before you can say that we should definitively start patients on medication X, you know, to relieve these symptoms. Additionally, the over-the-counter medications that we couldn't capture rigorously, it would have been great to know if patients were using sinus irrigations, using intranasal steroids. I think that would have been very beneficial because you can imagine that a patient who's on hormone replacement therapy might be seeing the doctor more frequently and might be more engaged in their care. And so even though we controlled for other medications and diagnoses, I would have wanted to know that. Additionally, there's not a lot of studies out there at this point that have included rigorous symptom scales. And so knowing whether or not there were significant improvements in SNOT scores or nose scores among patients who had HRT compared to those who didn't, even if they didn't undergo surgery, would have been really nice to see. And I think would also help us better put our flag in the sand and say that this is helping both with symptoms, with whether or not surgery is performed. And then also kind of distinguishing age a little bit better, and then estrogen formulation. Is something that would be helpful, knowing whether or not there's one route of estrogen that's helping patients more. And then we also didn't look at progesterone either, but that's another question to think about.
And then thinking about the clinical implications, how should practicing otolaryngologists interpret these findings? It sounds like it's a little early for us to be making any changes to our practice, but what should be on our minds?
Yeah, I agree. Like you just said, and like Dr. Oliver said as well, I think it's too early to really say anything definitive about how this might change our practice. But where I do think the greatest utility of this growing field of the literature is that it's opening the door for us as clinicians to have conversations with our patients about what could be influencing their symptoms, particularly if they're noticing that things are happening or fluctuating with the menstrual cycle, or if they're in perimenopause or are going through menopause, and this is when their symptoms started. I think that we have to know and have to be knowledgeable about the fact that reproductive hormones are changing and are associated with all sorts of not just physiologic changes, but also mechanistically, there's something that's going on here. And I think that patients appreciate being part of that conversation and being armed with that knowledge, because it helps them to make sense of their symptoms, mm-hmm. as opposed to just being like, why the heck did this all start, you know, when I turned 45, mm-hmm. you know, or at whatever age. And so I think that it helps us to validate what they're experiencing, even if we rightfully still have to acknowledge that there's a limit to where the science is right now that prevents us from really making strong clinically based recommendations. And I think beyond that, the more informed that we are, the better we're able to perform comprehensive care for our patients, even if we're not involved in that care. And what I mean by that is that it's a great opportunity to get patients plugged in with other resources. So for example, at university hospitals, there's a fantastic midlife women's health center that's run by this super passionate clinician, Dr. Sal McPherson, Ephedrine. And she is very passionate about bringing this sort of comprehensive perimenopausal and menopausal care to women, because as Dr. Oliver noted, the conversation for so long has been avoid HRT, it's bad, all sorts of bad things are going to happen if you start it, when the reality is when you go back and reinterrogate that data and combine it with more contemporary data as well, we know that that's no longer the case. Right. And so I think that as rhinologists, if we are doing things like getting a SNOT 22 and we see, yes, they've got the rhinologic symptoms that we're like, yes, this is our jam, we can probably help with this. But then they're also in that midlife season and they're having poor sleep and emotional disturbances and other symptoms. Like, we shouldn't just be like, ah, this is why the SNOT 22 is terrible, because all this stuff that's not rhinology related is being asked, right? This should be our opportunity to say, hey, you know, I'm confident I can help you with some of these rhinologic things, but it looks like some other stuff is going on here as well. You're in this season of life. Would you like to be referred to the folks that are really hormone experts to really holistically be able to improve your quality of life?
Yeah, I think that's a great space to advocate in, particularly in an area that's historically been very under-researched and very underrepresented as a part of healthcare. And then what do you guys think the next step is in terms of future research for this area? It sounds like we have a lot of questions to answer, but if you were going to do one study next, what would it be?
Dr. Smith, you know that research is my favorite thing. I can't be constrained to one next study. But I think what comes before the next pivotal study is continuing to advocate for change at a policy level so that these sorts of women's health related research is championed at a level that receives the funding that it deserves. Because that is what is required to do whatever the next high impact, prospective, well thought out interdisciplinary study will require. Because we want to look at things like cytology, histology, microbiome changes, symptom burden, imaging findings, olfaction, et cetera. And we can't do that if the resources and the passion within the scientific and policy communities don't reflect, you know, the urgency of this need.
This makes me even more glad that we decided to discuss your study today so that all of our listeners can be more familiar with this issue, but also with this area of medicine. And I know it's something that seemed really novel to me when I was looking at it, despite even the previous research that's come out in this space, because it just hadn't come across my desk before. So I'm really glad that we got to talk about this. Thank you both for joining me today. This has been a really fascinating discussion and highlighted, again, an area of rhinology that I think many of us don't think about often enough. I would like to encourage our listeners to read the full manuscript, which provides a really interesting look at how systemic hormonal therapy may influence surgical outcomes in nasal obstruction. Before we close, do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
My final thought sounds really cheesy, but I think it's just to stay curious, right? When we see patterns that don't make sense in our patients, or where we're like, something's probably going on here, but there's just no data, right? I think that's a place to really delve in and encourage us to keep listening to our patients to inform the research that we do so that it's of maximum impact, not only for the science, but for patient care.
I really like that. That's a great note to end on. Well, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations again to you both and all of your co-authors on this publication. This is Christine Smith for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. We're signing off for now. Until next time.